Hanging from a gold chain, the menorah medallion is most likely an ornament from a Torah scroll. If this is the case, it is the earliest Torah scroll ornament found in archaeological excavations to date. It was buried in a small depression in the floor, along with a smaller gold medallion, two pendants, a gold coil, and a silver clasp, all of which are believed to be Torah scroll ornamentations. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, Episode 120, The Ophel Treasure. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. In 2013, the Israeli archaeologist Eilat Mazar made one of her many remarkable discoveries. What she found this time was not a seal referencing a biblical figure such as Hezekiah or Isaiah or the ministers that served in Jerusalem in the time of Jeremiah. Nor did she find an archaeological artifact from the era of the Hasmonean period or of Roman rule. Rather, akin to a scene in a movie, what she uncovered was hidden gold, coins, and other objects, including a magnificent medallion emblazoned with images that indicated that this was a buried treasure that had been hidden by Jews. Thus the Times of Israel reports, quote, Hebrew University researchers on Monday announced the discovery of a rare trove of Byzantine-era gold and silver artifacts, the most impressive of which is a 10-centimeter solid gold medallion emblazoned with a menorah and other Jewish iconography. The find, unearthed in the area adjacent to the southern wall of the Temple Mount known as the Ophel, was dated to the early 7th century CE, in all likelihood the time of the brief Persian conquest of Jerusalem. Professor Eilat Mazar described the discovery as a unique find with very clear Jewish symbols. She posited that the hoard of gold and silver objects found beneath the floor of a Byzantine-era house meters from the massive walls of the Temple Mount was brought by Jews who returned to the city after the Persians conquered it from the Byzantines in 614 CE. "I have never found so much gold in my life," she said, with obvious excitement at a press conference on Mount Scopus. "I was frozen. It was unexpected." The centerpiece, a medallion that Mazar posited may have been used as an ornamentation for a Torah scroll, is emblazoned with a seven-armed candelabrum, a menorah, a Torah scroll, and a shofar, a ram's horn, end quote. What Mazar had uncovered, apparently, was a hidden hoard for funds and ritual adornments that Jews had stored in Jerusalem during the first part of the 7th century. The discovery is all the more intriguing because it was uncovered in one of the most ancient areas in Jerusalem. As the Biblical Archaeological Review tells us, quote, Eilat Mazar's excavation at the Ophel in Jerusalem was one of the most high-profile investigations in the field of biblical archaeology. The area between the City of David and the Temple Mount has been known as the Ophel, meaning a high place to climb to, since the First Temple period. In the Bible, King Yotam did much building on the wall of the Ophel, 11 Chronicles 27:3. In the mid-8th century BCE, and the site's history stretches back well before this construction, end quote. Thus, what Mazar uncovered is called today the Ophel Treasure, a treasure in the area of ancient Jerusalem that had been hidden in the 7th century CE. But how could Jews have placed gold in Jerusalem at that time period if, as we have discussed during Byzantine rule, they were largely banned from any real ritual or presence in Jerusalem? How could Jews have made it into the city with an entire treasure trove, and why would they have done so? Why would they have created a medallion adorned with profoundly Jewish symbols? The answer, as Mazar herself suggested, seems to lie in a brief period of Jewish return to Jerusalem, and her discovery reflects the larger Jewish relationship with Jerusalem. After the Empress Eudoxia's brief attempt to allow a Jewish return to Jerusalem, the Byzantine period marked many years in which the Jewish community of the Holy Land had very limited access to the sacred city and indeed to the larger area of Yehuda, Judea. As Hebrew University Oded Irshai put it in an interview, quote, "From then on, Judea and Jerusalem became the center of attention for the Christians." So how did the Jews respond to this? To that, we have no real answer. There were very few Jews left in Judea. Most of the Jewry in Roman Palestine is concentrated along the coastline, in the Galilee and the Golan Heights. There is a divide in Roman Palestine from the point of settlement. Galilee was mainly Jewish. Judea was mainly Christian, end quote. During the 6th century, Jews suffered under the reign of Justinian, whose edicts clearly targeted Jewish observance. Then, in the early 7th century, the king of Persia sought to expand his empire by invading the Holy Land, and the Jewish community allied with this Persian king, seeking to return to Jerusalem. And there are intriguing indications from the Cairo Geniza that Jews actually made it back to the Temple Mount and restored worship there. The way in which we know this is even more interesting if one understands the legacy of the figure whose writings provide this evidence. Elazar HaKalir was a 7th century Paitan, liturgical composer, who lived in the Holy Land. And to this day, the Ashkenazic community's kinot, elegies of mourning, recited on the 9th of Av, are taken to a great extent from Elazar's compositions. It is, in his words, that generations of Jews have wept and mourned for Jerusalem, have remembered Jerusalem, have conjured up images of Jerusalem in their minds. It's all the more interesting, then, that from one unpublished piyut, one piece of liturgical writing found in the Cairo Knesset collection, a piece by Elazar HaKalir, we have a description not only of Jews returning to Jerusalem, but also of Jews actually beginning rituals on the Temple Mount itself again. Bar Ilan University's Meir Loewenberg, in an article about the Jewish relationship with the Temple Mount throughout history, tells us the following. Quote, "We also know from the Babylonian Talmud that Jews did go up and pray on the Temple Mount in the 4th century, since Rabbi Bibi, who lived at that time, instructed them not to spit on the Temple Mount, not to carry a walking stick, not to wear shoes, not to carry a coin purse, and not to use the Temple Mount as a shortcut, because all these behaviors degrade the holiness of the place. But for the 5th and 6th centuries, there are no records to indicate that Jews were allowed to pray on the Temple Mount. King Chosru II of Persia, 591 to 628, invaded Palestine in the second decade of the 7th century. This campaign was part of his attempt to reestablish the ancient Achaemenid Empire. Prior to conquering Jerusalem, Chosru promised the Jews of Palestine that a Jewish governor would be appointed as ruler over the city. He did appoint Nehemiah, son of Hushiel, as governor of Jerusalem. Once appointed, Nehemiah proceeded to reestablish the sacrificial service on the Temple Mount. Rabbi Elazar Kalir, one of the earliest and most prolific of Jewish liturgical poets who lived in Palestine at the time of the Persian invasion, described these events in one of his liturgical poems, Piyutim, as follows. "When Assyria, Persia, came to the city and pitched his tents there, the holy people were a bit relieved because he permitted the reestablishment of the temple, and they built there the holy altar and offered upon it holy sacrifices, but they did not manage to build the temple because the Messiah had not yet come. But," Loewenberg continues, "the Persians executed Nehemiah before long. Perhaps they feared his messianic pretensions, or they suspected that he was planning to organize a rebellion, or they made a strategic decision that the support of the larger Christian population was more valuable than the support of the smaller number of Jews living in Palestine. The Persian control of the city," Loewenberg further writes, "did not last long. The Byzantine Emperor Heraclius, 575 to 641, waged a bitter war against the Persians to regain his lost provinces of Syria, Egypt, and Palestine. He successfully destroyed the Persian army in 628, and in the following year marched at the head of his army into Jerusalem." End quote. What this means is that there was a small period of time in which the Jews returned to Jerusalem and to the locus of their longing, and for Mazar, it was during this period that the treasure would have been brought by Jews into Jerusalem. As ScienceDaily.com tells us, quote, "Given the date of the items and the manner in which they were found, Mazar estimates they were abandoned in the context of the Persian conquest of Jerusalem in 614 CE. After the Persians conquered Jerusalem, many Jews returned to the city and formed the majority of its population, hoping for political and religious freedom." End quote. And it's with this in mind that we can better unpack the symbolism of the gold medallion discovered, part of what Mazar correctly called a breathtaking once-in-a-lifetime discovery. And as Mazar added, quote, "We have been making significant finds from the First Temple period in this area, a much earlier time in Jerusalem's history. So discovering a golden seven-branched menorah from the 7th century AD at the foot of the Temple Mount was a complete surprise," end quote. The images on the medallion are incredibly interesting, and if we study them, we suddenly realize how the medallion combines symbols that we have seen throughout our studies, which reflect the Jewish connection to Jerusalem and to the Temple. First and foremost, there is the menorah, made of seven branches, as it was in the Temple, with the tripod base, which, as we have seen, was a symbol by Jews in the Holy Land and throughout the diaspora of their connection to the Temple and their memory of it. Then there is also on the medallion the lulav, the palm frond of Sukkot. And as we have seen again and again, it is the celebration of Sukkot that over and over throughout Jewish history marked the Jewish rededication of devotion to the Temple, from the biblical period to the Hasmoneans to the Mishnaic rabbis to the time of the Empress Eudoxia. And then there is another image, a scroll, a Torah scroll, which is not only the source of Jewish law, wisdom, and knowledge, but also the holiest object in the synagogue, one which would have been taken out for public readings. And the synagogue, as we have just discussed, had become the central institution through which the Jewish connection to Jerusalem was preserved through which the memory of the temple's rituals was maintained, remembered, and transmitted from generation to generation. It is therefore striking that for Mazar, this medallion was created for a synagogue near the Temple Mount itself, meant to adorn that holiest object in that synagogue, a way of honoring the Torah scroll. Thus, Ynet News describing the discovery informs us that, quote, hanging from a gold chain, the menorah medallion is most likely an ornament from a Torah scroll. If this is the case, it is the earliest Torah scroll ornament found in archaeological excavations to date. It was buried in a small depression in the floor, along with a smaller gold medallion, two pendants, a gold coil, and a silver clasp, all of which are believed to be Torah scroll ornamentations. It would appear that the most likely explanation is that the Ophel cache was earmarked as a contribution toward the building of a new synagogue at a location that is near the Temple Mount, said Dr. Mazar. End quote. Of course, the very fact that the coins and the medallion were never retrieved testifies to the brief nature of the Jewish presence in Jerusalem in the 7th century, or as Mazar said, what is certain is that their mission, whatever it was unsuccessful. The treasure was abandoned, and its owners could never return to collect it, end quote. The discovery in the area of ancient Jerusalem of a treasure testifying to the Jewish return to 7th century Jerusalem by an archaeologist working in modern Jerusalem reflects the relationship of the Jewish people to the city over the ages, reminding us how Jerusalem, with its sacred mountain, was seen as embodying the greatest treasure of all. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.